Welcome to Rural EdMed. I am your host, Serena Wilson, an acute care nurse practitioner, and I will be speaking about point-of-care ultrasound. I will start out by saying that I am not proficient in the use of bedside ultrasound. I understand that it is the big new thing, especially in emergency departments and intensive care units. There's a lot of research supporting its use. I trained at an institution where it was commonplace. It is basically unheard of at my current institution. Considering our lack of on-call ultrasound technicians and sometimes any ultrasound availability in rural medicine, I decided to look into this topic a little more. I read some books and journal articles, listened to podcasts, talked to experts, and attended a medical conference training course. I think that the basic application is easily learned. I think we could bring this to my place of employment and make a real difference in how we manage patients. Let me know what you think in the comments. Do you already use this? How hard was it for you to learn it? Does it sound like a plausible thing to do? Before we can talk about ultrasound, we need to discuss sound. Sound is vibrations that are transmitted and then interpreted by the structures of the ear and the brain. Ultrasound is simply a frequency of sound. The specially shaped auricle, or outer ear, guides sound waves through the external acoustic auditory meatus, where the tympanic membrane, or eardrum, is vibrated. A set of three bones, first the malleus, then incus, then stapes, move rhythmically with the eardrum to tap out a sound wave that is thus transmitted to the vestibule of the inner ear. The vestibule is the first section of the inner ear. It is a hollow cavity that connects the cochlea, or organ of the sound, with the outer ear and the semicircular canals that are involved in head motion, balance, and direction. Transmission of sound is accomplished by compression of the fluid of the cochlea, or endolymph, between two flexible membranes on each end of the cochlea, known as the oval and round windows. The lever action of the malleus, incus, and stapes actually amplifies the sound as well as transmits it. The tapping piston motion of the last of the three bones, the stapes, causes movement of the oval window that underlies it. Because fluid is non-compressible, it moves forward until it hits the round window membrane, which is able to bow outwards to accommodate the movement and then transmit it back towards the oval window, which behaves in the same way. The distance this wave travels determines the quality of the sound. The motion of the fluid causes bending of stereocilia, leading to depolarization and subsequent transmission of the sound via the inner ear hair cells to the auditory or eighth cranial nerve at the organ of Corti. It is here that mechanical sound is converted to action potentials that will be transmitted to the brain. Cilia are located at the ends of the hair cells that sprout from the organ of Corti. Each cilia is connected to the taller cilia behind it with a hinge-like door to potassium channels. With movement of endolymph, or potassium-rich fluids in which cilia are bathed, the cilia may bend towards taller cilia, which in turn opens the potassium channels. Potassium rushes into the cilia and triggers calcium channels. This causes fast depolarization and thus transmission of the auditory signal. Sound causes movement as it travels through a medium such as air or endolymph. When sound hits an object, it may either bounce off it, reflection, or go around it, diffraction. There are some measurements of sound you should probably know. As sound is only detected by the vibrations that it produces in objects or substances, it makes sense to measure the length of time that a particular sound causes vibrations. This is known as the period. It is usually measured in milliseconds. The reciprocal period is the frequency, or how many periods completed in 1 second. The unit of measurement for frequency, or cycles per second, is hertz. The sounds generated by human speech are usually between 100 and 220 hertz, but the human ear is capable of picking up frequencies between 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz, or 20,000 hertz. Ultrasound is simply sounds which have higher frequencies than can be heard by the human ear, or greater than 20 kilohertz. Most sounds in the megahertz, millions, range behave a little differently than other sounds. They are less likely to diffract or go around objects and are more likely to reflect even off of small objects. Ultrasound waves used in medical ultrasonography are between a frequency of 2 and 10 megahertz. How can you tell how far away something is? Attenuation is the dampening of a sound wave as it is reflected back to its source. For a wave that is more attenuated, the further away the reflecting substance is. So basically, distance decreases the volume of sound, which is measured in decibels. Decibels are a comparative unit of measurement rather than absolute. Something is not just 3 decibels in volume, it is 3 decibels in comparison to another noise, which will always be 1. 3 decibels in this case is a sound that is twice as loud. 10 decibels is 10 times as loud, 20 is 100 times, and 30 decibels is 1,000 times louder. Decibels can be negative numbers, too, to connotate quieter sounds. The speed of sound in any given medium is always the same. Fortunately, different frequencies of some sound waves require different size objects to reflect back from. Adjusting the frequency on the ultrasound machine allows one to detect smaller objects at higher frequencies, thus improving the quality of the picture obtained. This is because higher frequency sounds generate shorter wavelengths. Higher frequency sounds will pick up smaller objects and more detail, but due to its shorter wavelength, doesn't penetrate as deep as lower frequency sounds. Longer wavelengths are more likely to diffract or go around small objects. I imagine this like a slinky. If you have a short slinky and you uncoil it towards a small object, if it is almost at its full length when it encounters that object, it is already about to come back. It is slowed down in its travels, and so very little energy is required to reverse its trajectory. The force of its recoil is approaching the force of its forward speed motion already. The small object is all it needs to push it into its return trip. If you have a large slinky and it encounters a small object early on, it will probably get tangled in the object or be pushed to the side, but the object won't be enough to cause a return trip. Boundaries between two different tissues is the easiest thing for ultrasound to pick up. That is because each tissue has a different rate of speed that the sound wave will travel through it. When a sound wave reaches the interface between two different tissues, part of the sound waves will be reflected back, and part of them will go on through the new substance. If the rate through which sound travels through two different substances are similar, no boundary will be shown on the ultrasound image. A common problem with ultrasound is artifact. The ultrasound machine always assumes it is reflecting sound waves off objects at 90 degrees, which is necessarily impossible. Refraction, or bending, of the path of the sound wave occurs when the signal is actually oblique to the border between the objects having different impedance when the sound wave transitions from one to the other. Acoustic shadowing is when the ultrasound wave comes in contact with a substance it cannot pass through, such as a gallstone, and so the area behind that obstruction appears as black. Posterior acoustic enhancement is when a sound wave can travel through specific media really fast, such as an abscess or bleed, and so the matter behind that area appears with increased echogenicity or whiteness. Reverberation is when echoes get trapped between two parallel substances that reflect the sound waves back and forth off each other. This only happens when the ultrasound probe is aligned perpendicular to the parallel reflectors. This can create bright and dark white stripes that do not actually represent any substance, rings all along an object, or comet tails that merge and obscure surrounding areas. Different substances appear different on ultrasound based on how fast sound waves can travel through them. Sound waves travel faster through objects with less density and more stiffness. More dense substances impede wave travel. An acoustic window is an organ or substance of the body which is acoustically homogeneous, that is, will not show barriers on ultrasound which detract from the intensity of the sound wave by reflecting some of the energy back. Fluids are often used for this purpose because they appear on the ultrasound as clear, echo-free areas. The liver is also often used as an acoustic window. Acoustic barriers impede the flow of ultrasound, either through absorption or heavy reflection of energy. Acoustic barriers include bone and gas. There are a number of different modes of ultrasound. We will only be using three of them in point-of-care ultrasound. 2D echo is basic reflection of sound waves off of substances or objects. This mode provides a real-time image of structures and movement of those structures. The images appear as shades of black, white, and gray. M mode provides a one-dimensional view with higher resolutions for accurate measurements. Color flow Doppler ultrasound uses colors to represent direction and velocity of blood flow and superimposes these images over a 2D image. There are a number of types of different probes used during point-of-care ultrasonography. First, there is a curved array probe. Just like it sounds, it is a long, skinny probe which curves along the bottom in a half-moon shape. This type of probe is best for detecting abdominal injuries, such as retroperitoneal bleed and OB conditions. It is a low-frequency probe, so resolution is not the best. The phased array probe also uses lower frequencies. It is small and almost square. It is best used for bedside cardiac studies and frequently used for the FAST exam. A linear array probe is long and skinny and rectangular. It uses higher frequencies and so gives excellent images of very small areas. This is the probe most commonly used for vascular access. There are also endocavitary probes that are used to look intraorally or transvaginal. In order to understand the pictures you obtain, you will need to understand the different planes of the body. The transverse or axial plane divides the body into inferior and superior portions. A transverse plane is what you are looking at when you roll through a sequence of chest abdominal CT images. You start at the heart and lungs, move into the liver, kidneys, intestines, then pelvis. A sagittal or horizontal plane divides the body into right and left halves. The sagittal plane is usually what you are seeing when you look at a diagram of the internal structures of the brain, such as the corpus callosum, the hippocampus, and hypothalamus. A coronal plane divides the body vertically into ventral or belly side and dorsal or backside. A coronal plane is what you are typically looking at on a head CT as you move from the face to the posterior head. This allows you to see the two halves of the brain side by side to evaluate symmetry to get a clear picture of the lateral and third ventricles. The most well-known form of point-of-care ultrasonography is the FAST exam, or focused assessment with sonography in trauma. This is used in trauma to quickly identify dangerous bleeding requiring surgical intervention. This has all but replaced diagnostic peritoneal lavage, which was highly accurate at detecting peritoneal bleeding, but had many false positives, leading to unnecessary testing and procedures. There was an especially high rate of false positives with this technique in pelvic fracture. A basic FAST exam has four components: pericardial, perihepatic or right upper quad, perisplenic or left upper quad, and pelvic. The pelvic portion includes either the rectovesicular or rectouterine spaces, depending on gender. The FAST exam starts with a pericardial view. A phased array probe is most often used for this. It is placed slightly to the right of the xiphoid process and pointed slightly towards the left shoulder. The probe's orientation marker should be pointed towards the patient's right shoulder. This allows the viewer to use the patient's liver as an acoustic window. The probe should be pointed towards the patient's shoulder, but the probe should still be flat perpendicular to the skin, so the probe is held in a pincher fashion and pressed in and under the xiphoid. As the probe is directed up from the bottom of the heart and midway back, the ultrasound image should be a mirror image of what you would expect. Blood appears black with the surrounding chamber walls as white. The two chambers to the right superior corner of the ultrasound image should be the right ventricle in the medial side and left ventricle to the right of that. You will have a very clear view of the right atrium and tricuspid valve, which will be opening into the right ventricle. Remember that the heart sits in the chest angled with the left apex closest to the chest wall and the right heart angled posteriorly. This makes sense then that your clearest view coming up from and slightly behind the apex would be the right atrium with the right ventricle being closest to the probe. It is a coronal view of the heart, or a division of the heart into ventral and dorsal sections. The precordial view is used in the FAST exam to diagnose pericardial effusion. The pericardium usually presents as hyperechoic or a white line around the muscle of the heart. A pericardial effusion will show the fluid surrounding the heart as a black line within the white line. The anechoic or black line will present as much thicker with bigger effusions. If you find a pericardial effusion, there are further steps you must take to determine if it is negatively impacting cardiac function. Size doesn't matter. It will usually be the chronicity that will determine how much cardiac impact there will be. We will discuss this further when we talk about point-of-care cardiac ultrasonography. To view Morrison's pouch, the probe is angled obliquely between the ribs and the intercostal space with the orientation marker towards the patient's posterior right axilla. It is placed anywhere between the 8th and 11th ribs at the mid-axillary line. From this view, anechoic stripes either at the liver-kidney interface, also known as Morrison's pouch, or the liver-diaphragm interface would represent abnormal fluid collection. The length of the anechoic or black stripe can be used to roughly estimate the amount of fluid. 1 centimeter correlates to about 1 liter of fluid. In the right upper quadrant, the hepatorenal recess or Morrison's pouch is a potential space between the liver and the right kidney. Under normal circumstances, there is no space visualized between these structures. On ultrasound, the liver appears more linear and the kidney is oval. Both appear as echogenic. Fluid appears between the two as a black line or space. As little as 100 cc's of fluid can be visualized in Morrison's pouch due to its dependent nature when a patient is lying supine. The lowest potential spaces of a supine patient are the hepatorenal recess, the splenorenal recess, and the pelvis, which are great places to look for blood after an injury. Overflow fluids from Morrison's pouch may spill into the right pericolic gutter. This is a potential space between the colon and posterior abdominal wall lateral to the colon. It stretches from the superior hepatic flexure all the way down into the pelvis. It wraps around the cecum and is continuous with the peritoneum. The purpose of the pericolic gutters are probably to drain blood and infectious material away from the abdominal organs. The right pericolic gutter drains into the rectovesicular space in males and the rectouterine, or pouch of Douglas, in females. The left pericolic gutter runs along the descending colon on the left. It is not continuous with the splenorenal recess due to the phrenicocolic ligament that runs across this area and secures the top left colon. Fluid from the splenorenal recess tends to flow across the midline to the right upper quadrant as a result of being cut off from this left space. The left pericolic gutter also drains into the pelvis. It is a much more shallow space. Because of the loculating location of the phrenicocolic ligament, small amounts of left upper quadrant fluid is more likely to be found in the left subphrenic space. In viewing the splenorenal recess, the much smaller and posteriorly positioned spleen must be used as the acoustic window. The proper placement of the probe is therefore at the posterior axillary line, angled towards the anterior. The view is usually found at the 6th to 9th ribs intercostal spaces, again with the probe turned obliquely. This view is notoriously the most difficult to obtain. If unable to view it, move the probe up 2 rib spaces or ask the patient to take a deep breath in. Finally, to view the pelvic area, place the probe 2 centimeters above the pubic symphysis with the marker turned towards the patient's head for a longitudinal view. A longitudinal view is a cross-sectional view of the, and the prostate or uterus will appear laterally to the bladder. In a male, the prostate marks the end of the peritoneal space. Fluid that accumulates here will be superior or posterior to the bladder. For the transverse view of the pelvis, just turn the probe counterclockwise and angled slightly to the patient's right. This will give you a view of the bladder looking up from the bottom of the peritoneum. The uterus or prostate will usually show up in this view inferior to the bladder. In a female, the probe is placed in the same spot. The difference is that you will be able to visualize an ovalish, whitish structure lateral to the bladder that is the uterus, and there will be no prostate. Cardiac ultrasound consists of four basic views, including the parasternal long and short axis, subxiphoid or subcostal, and apical views. Bedside cardiac ultrasound is quite useful for getting rapid clinical information in the setting of sudden hypotension, chest pain, unexplained shortness of breath, and dizziness or fainting. Positioning of the patient can be crucial during this procedure. The left lateral or heart down position brings the heart closer to the anterior chest wall. The parasternal long axis view, or PSLA, is obtained with a phased array probe placed on the skin to the left of the sternum, with the probe marker pointed towards the patient's right shoulder. It is dragged along the chest from the second to fifth intercostal space until the best picture is obtained. This may be any of these intercostal spaces, depending on the patient's anatomy. The PSLA provides the best view of the left heart and the aorta. The image will show the long aorta with an aortic valve in the center, which runs into the left ventricle to the left. Above and below these structures are the right ventricle on top and left atrium inferiorly. The usual depth of these structures is 12 to 16 centimeters and 20 to 24 centimeters if you're looking for pericardial or pleural fusions. The parasternal short axis view, or PSSA, is obtained with the phased array probe somewhere along the left sternal border, third through fifth intercostal space as well, but this time with the probe marker turned towards the left shoulder. This view allows you to assess global left ventricular function. The aortic valve level is obtained by tilting the transducer face to the right shoulder. This image shows the large tri-leaflet aortic valve in the center. To the right is the right atrium, and then moving superiorly, the right ventricle, and then moving to the left, the pulmonic valve and pulmonary artery. The left atrium is inferior to the aortic valve. The mitral valve short axis view is obtained with the transducer face flat on the chest. This view shows the right ventricle at the top and the left ventricle on the bottom. Near the center of the left ventricle is the mitral valve. The papillary muscle view is in the same location, but with the transducer face facing slightly down. This shows the right ventricle superiorly, the left inferiorly, and two papillary muscles within the bottom left ventricle. The proper depth for any of these views is also 12 to 16 centimeters. The apical four-chamber view allows you to assess all four chambers of the heart simultaneously. It is obtained by placing the probe under the left breast or inferior lateral to the left nipple with the probe marker pointed to the left hip or approximately the 3 o'clock position. The face of the probe should be angled up towards the base of the heart. The ultrasound picture will show a straight up and down picture of the heart, starting with the apex or two ventricles side by side and at the top and then two atria. The apical five-chamber view, which now includes the aorta, is obtained by simply tilting the transducer face upwards. The apical view is frequently used to evaluate for pericardial effusion and whether it is leading to tamponade. The usual depth for this view is a little deeper at 14 to 18 centimeters. The subcostal four-chamber view requires placement of the probe 2 to 3 centimeters under the xiphoid process with the probe marker facing the left hip of the patient, or the 3 o'clock position. The face of the probe must look up under the ribs and sternum into the left chest, but still be flush with the skin. This view differs in how the clinician holds the probe. Rather than holding it like a pencil, as in other views, the clinician uses his or her index finger to apply downward pressure to the probe while holding it laterally with the middle finger and thumb. This provides an excellent view of the four chambers. The probe points right up to the septum, which separates the two sides of the heart. The right ventricle will be on the top of the ultrasound image, with the right atrium down and to the left, and the left ventricle down and to the right. The aorta can sometimes be seen between the two atria. This view is best for evaluating pericardial effusion. The subcostal inferior vena cava view is obtained in the same position, but with the probe rotated 90 degrees until the orientation marker is at 12 o'clock. This is an important view for determining fluid responsiveness. Now that you know the basics of cardiac ultrasound, you're probably wondering, what can I do with it? Well, to start, assessment of ventricular function to look for a pericardial effusion and signs of tamponade, estimate left ventricular ejection fraction, determine volume status in a ventilated patient, look for signs of right heart strain associated with or actually see a pulmonary embolus, assess valvular function and movement and papillary muscles of the left heart, evaluate intrinsic function and determine when there isn't any. We start by looking at left ventricular wall size and motion. This is best done with the parasternal short axis papillary muscle view. You want to look for contraction during systole and symmetrical wall motion. Asymmetrical movement may occur with wall motion abnormalities associated with cardiac damage. This can be with significant myocardial infarction or as a complication of such. Left ventricular free wall rupture will show up as wall akinesis at the area of rupture and with echogenic or whitish pericardial effusion. This can be small and self-seal via hematoma formation or very large with sudden cardiac death. It can occur up to a month after intervention for heart attack and is often associated with EKG changes, leukocytosis, and elevation in inflammatory markers. It is frequently the cause of pulseless electrical activity in the post-infarction patient. It doesn't necessarily cause chest pain or a dramatic increase in troponin. Symptoms can include syncope, hypotension, chest pain, symptoms of tamponade, restlessness, or anxiety. Motion can also appear asymmetrical with any condition that causes increased right ventricular pressures or enlargement. In this case, the left ventricle will be flattened at the septum between the two ventricles in this same view. This can occur as a result of elevated pulmonary pressures, such as with PE or COPD. The left ventricle should get smaller during systole, but not disappear, as it may do in conditions of hypovolemia or severe pulmonary hypertension. Using the same view, you will want to evaluate the papillary muscles. Papillary muscle rupture usually occurs 2 to 7 days following a myocardial infarction and most often occurs after a person's first infarction. These patients develop acute onset hypotension, dyspnea, and a new systolic mitral regurgitation murmur. It is often associated with pulmonary edema. The parasternal long axis view can be used to compare the right and left ventricles. You simply rotate the probe until the left ventricle is at its biggest. At this point, the right ventricle should be less than two-thirds the size of the left ventricle. The apical view may show a bulging septum, indicative of elevated right heart pressures. Elevated right heart pressures could indicate anything from a pulmonary embolus, right heart failure, pulmonary hypertension, to severe tricuspid regurgitation. Keep in mind that a pulmonary embolus does not cause these right heart problems in hemodynamically stable patients, so it is not used for this purpose. In approximately 35% of PE patients, you may actually be able to see a clot within the pulmonary artery. Again, you also want to look at ventricular wall motion. Note akinesia, dyskinesia, and hypokinesia. Impaired motion may occur in the setting of right ventricular infarct. Because of its relatively hidden position and unreliable EKG changes, this may be an important way to evaluate for it. These changes in ventricular wall motion can be accompanied by paradoxical movement of the septum. Right ventricular infarct usually presents as right heart collapse on ultrasound. There are also wall motion abnormalities in PE, often sparing the apex of the right heart, unlike other causes of right heart strain. This is known as McConnell's sign. Pericardial effusion normally shows up as an anechoic line around the heart. The size of the effusion is not as important as the chronicity. The heart can tolerate a slow buildup of fluid because it has time to adapt. A rapid buildup is more likely to cause tamponade, even if the fluid amounts are very small. There are a few things you want to look for when evaluating for the presence of tamponade. Right atrial collapse will happen during systole and appears as a caving in of the atrial wall. Right ventricular collapse occurs during diastole and often will obliterate the hypoechoic area within the ventricle. It is best seen in the subxiphoid view and is known as a trampoline sign, named for the appearance while in motion. You can also evaluate the inflow variation across the mitral and tricuspid valves. Under normal conditions, respiration causes variation in flow rates here. Inspiration increases right ventricular flow by increasing venous return to the right heart through generation of negative intrathoracic pressure. Expiration makes the intrathoracic pressure more positive and increases flow through the left heart. The right heart is more likely to show collapse during expiration. A pulse wave Doppler ultrasound machine can be used to measure the variations in flow between inspiration and expiration at the mitral and tricuspid valves. You take the difference in flow rates divided by the flow rate during inspiration, or the higher flow rate, to get the percent difference. Normal values for the tricuspid flow rate variation is less than 25%, and the mitral valve is less than 15%. The mitral valve is located in the thicker left heart and so is less affected by pressure differences in the intrathoracic cavity. You can also look at the inferior vena cava, or IVC. In tamponade, the IVC will be dilated and show less collapse during expiration. Finally, in the parasternal long axis view, you may pick up pleural effusion in addition to pericardial. Rotate the probe until the descending aorta comes into view inferiorly. This will be the border that separates pleural from pericardial. If you do find that a patient is in tamponade, you will need to do a pericardiocentesis. Ultrasound guidance is the safest way to do this. This procedure can carry high risk of causing a pneumonia or puncturing a vessel without guidance. Either a subcostal or apical view are usually your best choices. Although going in where the effusion is greatest trumps all other recommendations. You want to place the needle in plane with the probe. This means that you place the needle lateral to the probe and angle it into the ultrasound line of sight. When going in subcostally, a curvilinear probe is probably your best choice. This probe provides the best image of the needle. By necessity, you must use the phased array probe for the apical view in order to see between the ribs. Because this podcast is on ultrasound specifically and not on procedures, I will not touch on the methods of pericardiocentesis beyond how to use the ultrasound to assist with this. Left ventricular ejection fraction, or LVEF, can be roughly estimated with point-of-care ultrasound. The experienced clinician can usually look at the movement of the heart and tell whether or not it is hyperdynamic, as in hyperthyroid or anemia, hypodynamic, as in congestive heart failure, or normal in movement. Some ultrasound machines have a LVEF calculation built right in. You can trace the volume of the left heart during systole and during diastole, and the machine will calculate the value. E-point septal separation, or EPSS, is a more simplistic measurement. Use the parasternal long axis view in M mode. This view shows the left ventricular wall and the intraventricular septum as parallel structures. Place the measurement line through the mitral valve where it abuts the septum. This will give you a value for your EPSS. Plug this into the formula. 75.5 minus 2.5 times the EPSS to obtain your LVEF. A normal EPSS is less than 5 millimeters. A LVEF less than 50% is an EPSS greater than 7, and an LVEF less than 30% is an EPSS greater than 18 millimeters. To conceptualize this, think of a good forceful ejection fraction pushing the mitral valve leaflet almost right up against the septum, and a poor ejection fraction only pushing the leaflet open a small amount and nowhere near the septum. Finally, you will want to evaluate the valves of the heart. Pay attention to valve mobility, anatomy, and function. Valve mobility is the easy fluid motion in which valves open and close. Reduced leaflet excursion during opening can indicate stenotic valves as well as reduced ejection fraction. Valve leaflets should open wide and almost meet the walls of surrounding structures. EPSS is used to measure mitral valve excursion. If you remember, a normal EPSS is less than 5 millimeters. Normal aortic valve excursion results in leaflets that open parallel to the septum. Abnormal leaflet movements can indicate stenosis, regurgitation, and even prolapse. Doming is when the valve opens but not wide or fast enough, and the ejection through that valve hits part of the leaflet, causing it to dome outward in the direction of blood flow. Bowing occurs when the valve is closed and the pressure of contraction against the closed valve causes it to balloon outward. This usually indicates prolapse. Fluttering of the AV valves may be seen during diastole with valve regurgitation. The valves are open during this period, but floppy. There should be some degree of left and right heart synchrony of valve movement. Coaptation occurs when valve leaflets actually touch when closed. Incomplete coaptation can indicate valve emergencies in which valves are no longer functioning or severe regurgitation. Stenotic valves have much thicker leaflets than is normal. They also may appear as hyperechoic or brighter white than other structures, indicating calcification. Depending on the view, individual leaflets can be visualized. Doppler color flow ultrasound can also be used to look for regurgitation. Typically, the only hemodynamically significant valve regurgitation is that occurring in the left heart due to its higher pressures. Moderate to severe mitral regurgitation and the presence of fever is very suspicious for endocarditis, whether or not vegetations are seen. Vegetations or clots are difficult to see with transthoracic echo, so their absence doesn't rule endocarditis out. Papillary muscle rupture can also cause these symptoms, although fever would probably be low grade if present in this situation. Moderate to severe aortic valve regurgitation could also indicate endocarditis and occurs during aortic dissection as well. Point of care ultrasound is rapid bedside evaluation completed by the provider to evaluate for injury and function. 2D echo shows basic motion and structure as well as fluid collections. M mode can be used to make measurements, calculate volumes, and estimate values for functions such as ejection fraction. Color flow Doppler echo shows direction of flow and velocities using color scales. Cardiac ultrasound can provide focused information during assessment of patients with undifferentiated dyspnea, trauma, following or during an MI, and help guide resuscitative measures. The FAST exam identifies fluid and air collections that may necessitate emergent surgery or other intervention. These modalities provide information much faster than other diagnostic techniques, including formal ultrasound by a licensed technician. Results do not need to be read by a radiologist or cardiologist. The patient is not exposed to harmful radiations or the risks associated with invasive procedures and monitoring. Point-of-care ultrasound is a high-yield, low-risk, low-cost tool for rapid evaluation. Again, please leave comments or questions on the website. And thanks for listening.